Imagine sitting down with your partner on like a Tuesday night, right across the kitchen table, and you're drafting a legally binding contract.
Right, which sounds serious.
Yeah, super serious. But you aren't dividing up finances, you aren't setting rules for a new house, and you definitely aren't talking about custody.
Far from it, actually.
Exactly. You are literally negotiating exactly who gets to play a video game, like
Yeah.
what chores have to be completed to earn that screen time, and for how many hours the other person is allowed to just, pretend they don't exist.
It's wild. It sounds like a comedy sketch, honestly.
It really does. But it is a very real document that went completely viral. And I mean, it is just the perfect window into the reality we live in right now.
Oh, absolutely. It illustrates this massive societal pivot we're in. The digital worlds we're creating have become so dense and like so demanding that they're literally forcing us to draft new rules for our physical day-to-day lives just to accommodate them.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we have got our hands on the July 2026 18th edition of iGaming Magazine, which is published by LODJ Media.
A really fascinating issue, by the way.
Oh, packed with stuff. Our mission for this deep dive is to explore how gaming has just completely mutated. We are moving way past the era of, a simple childhood pastime.
Right, way past that.
We were looking at a high-stakes, multi-billion-dollar pillar of global pop culture that has profound, honestly, sometimes shocking real-world consequences. So whether you're a hardcore gamer or just trying to understand why your coworkers are taking vacation days for a video game, you need to hear this.
You really do.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the absolute cultural behemoth that sparked that household contract in the first place, which is Grand Theft Auto 6.
Yeah, the GTA 6 phenomenon, it really is the definitive case study for how mainstream interactive entertainment alters human relationships on a mass scale.
Right.
When a mega blockbuster of this magnitude launches, we see a complete disruption of normal societal rhythms. I mean, people's sleep schedules just evaporate.
Totally gone.
Yeah, and basic biological needs like eating regular meals are suddenly treated as optional side quests. You know, you might grab a handful of chips if your character is driving across the map, but otherwise, the priority is entirely virtual.
And the magazine details how group chats just explode into absolute chaos. Or conversely, they go entirely dormant because everyone goes completely offline in the real world to just exist together in the virtual one.
Exactly.
I look at the launch of GTA 6 and it doesn't feel like a product release. It feels like a major natural weather event.
That's a great way to put it.
Or like a new global holiday. It's a hurricane of hype that sweeps through society, and you just have to board up your windows, stock up on groceries, and ride it out.
Just hunker down, yeah.
But I have to ask, is drafting a legal style document with your significant other over a video game just absolute peak 2026 behavior? Or is this the new normal?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we have to look at the architecture of the game itself to really understand the behavior it creates. Grand Theft Auto is no longer a linear story where you beat the final boss and, you know, put the box back on the shelf.
Right.
Rockstar Games builds digital playgrounds. These are persistent alternate realities.
Because the predecessor, GTA 5, kept people hooked for over a decade.
Exactly. But it wasn't just the base game that kept them engaged for 10 years. It was the digital infrastructure built around it. Players effectively took the keys to the city.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they were running their own role-playing servers where they took on actual jobs as virtual paramedics or taxi drivers. So, you know, GTA 6 isn't just a new story. It is laying the concrete for a new decade-long obsession.
Right, they're settling in.
Players aren't just completing missions, they are testing the physics engine, which is basically the complex, invisible math that dictates how a car crumples when it hits a wall, or how gravity affects a character falling off a building.
It's insane.
They're customizing properties, socializing, and just living in an ecosystem that developers spent billions of dollars perfecting.
And it has completely shattered the walls of niche gaming culture. I mean, the magazine points out that this launch crossed over into mainstream celebrity culture almost instantly.
Oh, big time.
You have Millie Bobby Brown, who is one of the most recognizable actresses on the planet from Stranger Things, publicly discussing GTA 6. And the internet tracks her comments about a video game with the exact same intensity they use to track tabloid romances.
Which is wild, but her involvement proves that gaming is now the prevailing water cooler conversation. When Hollywood A-listers are centering their public persona around a video game launch, it signals that the cultural center of gravity has, like, permanently shifted away from the movie theater and into the virtual open world.
It's fascinating that people will sacrifice their real-world time and relationships for virtual turf in GTA. But that blurring of reality isn't just costing people time.
No, not at all.
It's actively warping how we value physical objects in the real world. Which brings us to a 36-year-old man, a stack of cardboard, and a 10-year federal prison sentence.
Yeah, this transition from the social impact to the financial and legal impact is where the lingering innocence of the gaming hobby truly vanishes.
It really does. According to iGaming magazine, this man was recently sentenced to over a decade in prison for stealing approximately $21,000 worth of Pokemon cards.
Unbelievable.
And wait, a piece of cardboard is getting someone a decade in prison. I really need to push back on this for a second, because if you're listening to this thinking, there is no way a piece of paper with a shiny rat on it is worth grand larceny, I am right there with you.
I get it. I totally get it.
If you had told me in the 1990s that stealing a holographic Charizard would carry the exact same legal weight as a major jewelry heist, I would have thought you were crazy.
Mm.
It sounds bizarre when you say it out loud.
Mm.
It is literally treated like stealing a Rolex.
It is. What's fascinating here is the mechanism of how that cardboard accrued that value. The physical object itself, like the ink and the paper, hasn't changed since the 90s.
Right.
What changed is the psychology of the market. Back then, these cards were shoved into kids' backpacks, traded on blacktops, and, you know, accidentally destroyed in the washing machine.
Oh, my mom probably washed the equivalent of a small mortgage in the laundry when I was 10. It honestly hurts to think about.
So many people did. But today, they are treated like blue chip stocks.
Wow.
And for those unfamiliar with financial terms, a blue chip stock is a highly reliable, massively valued asset, like owning shares in Apple or Nike. Pokemon cards have essentially entered that territory.
But how did we get from the playground to the vault? Like, how did that happen?
It's the direct result of adult disposable income colliding with the mechanics of the modern internet. The kids who crumpled those cards in 1999 are now in their 30s with real money to spend, and they're desperately chasing their own nostalgia.
Makes sense.
And then you inject the influencer economy. Massive live streaming events and viral unboxing videos created this artificial scarcity and incredible hype.
You're talking about those videos where a streamer opens a sealed pack on camera and they scream at the top of their lungs because they pulled a rare shiny card from a foil wrapper and like thousands of people are watching live.
Exactly, that vicarious thrill. The industry responded to that hype by professionalizing the hobby.
Right.
You don't just put a card in a binder anymore. You send it to a grading company. They scrutinize it under a microscope for centering and edge wear, and they seal it in a tamper-proof plastic slab with a numeric grade.
It's so intense.
It is. This process transformed a children's game into a highly volatile, high-stakes asset class. And the dark side of creating a high-stakes asset class is that you inevitably attract actual organized criminals.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The theft of $21,000 worth of cards isn't a crime of passion by a nerdy kid. It is a calculated felony-level heist targeting liquid assets.
It blows my mind that the ecosystem around these games is so powerful it creates its own high-stakes black market.
Mm-hmm.
But nostalgia isn't just driving up the price of cardboard on the secondary market.
Not at all.
The developers themselves are actively weaponizing that exact same nostalgia to ensure they have complete control over your daily routine.
The mechanism they use for this is highly sophisticated. They are engineering ecosystems designed to capture your attention, and they rely on really specific psychological trends to ensure you never actually log off.
Let's look at what the magazine says about the mobile market as, like, the first piece of this trap. Harry Potter. Hogwarts Mystery is running updates that bring back content from the Sorcerer's Stone era, paired with these really intricate daily scavenger hunts.
Right.
They are taking your warmest childhood memories and just drip-feeding them back to you on your phone to keep you distracted while you wait for the next massive console game to come out.
The underlying psychology there relies on compulsion loops and something called the sunk cost fallacy.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so major console releases, like GTA 6, take 5 to 10 years to develop. During that massive silence, intellectual properties need a way to maintain cultural relevance.
The kids just disappear.
Exactly. Mobile games like Hogwarts Mystery don't rely on cutting-edge graphics. They rely on daily check-ins. If you log in every day, you get a tiny hit of dopamine through a reward.
Just a little ping of satisfaction.
Right. But if you miss a day, you break your streak and lose progress. It manipulates the player into feeling like they have invested too much time to quit.
And then, when you finally look up from your phone and turn on your console, you realize they're running the exact same playbook, just with different tools.
Yep.
The magazine breaks down the PlayStation Plus monthly subscription lineup for July 2026. Sony is handing players Call of Duty, Modern Warfare 3, For the King 2, and CrossCode.
A very specific trio.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because when you look at that list, it is definitely not a random assortment of games they just threw together. It is a perfectly curated buffet designed so you never, ever leave the restaurant.
The curation is deliberate, because platforms are constantly battling against a metric called churn rate.
Okay, what is that?
Churn is the percentage of subscribers who cancel their monthly $15 fee because they feel burned out or bored. To prevent churn, you have to manage the player's psychological energy.
Right. So you have your massive, loud, explosive, blockbuster main course with Call of Duty.
Yep. Adrenaline pumping.
Exactly. It's all high adrenaline, reflex-based shooting. But human beings cannot sustain that heart rate all day. So instead of letting you turn off the console to calm down, they serve you a slow, tactical meal with Through the King 2.
Which is a tabletop strategy game, heavily leaning into what the industry calls roguelike mechanics.
Right, which are brutal.
Very. For anyone unfamiliar, a roguelike is a game where, when your character dies, you lose almost everything and are forced to start from scratch. It is agonizingly slow, deeply tactical, and forces you to think three steps ahead rather than just reacting.
So the total opposite of Call of Duty.
It is the exact opposite.
It is the kind of co-op game that will absolutely ruin a real-world friendship if someone makes a bad move on the board.
Oh, absolutely.
And then, once you're exhausted from all the strategy, they offer you a sweet, retro-inspired RPG dessert with CrossCode to tap right back into that nostalgia we were talking about earlier.
And by offering those distinct decompression games in the exact same subscription library, Sony is effectively playing the role of casino manager.
Wow, yeah.
They are keeping you on the floor. When you get tired of the high-stakes poker table of Call of Duty, they don't want you going home to sleep. They gently walk you over to the penny slots of a retro RPG. Your attention is entirely monopolized within their walled garden.
Monopolized, monetized, and trapped in an ecosystem. But to keep those walled gardens running, you know, to support those massive blockbusters and visually stunning cinematic worlds, the actual physical hardware has to constantly evolve.
That's the engine driving it all.
And that evolution is forcing a massive shift in how we actually own or don't own the games we are pouring all this time and money into. The magazine gives us a look at the upcoming October 29th release of Demon Slayer, the Hinokami Chronicles 2, launching on the Nintendo Switch 2.
Which serves as the perfect example of hardware bottlenecks driving consumer trends.
The article breaks down how this game is an arena fighter, which is basically a 3D fighting game where characters run around huge environments throwing massive attacks at each other.
Very visually intense.
Super intense. The whole appeal of Demon Slayer is its cinematic, enemy-style battles, featuring these flashy elemental breathing techniques where the screen just fills with rendered water and fire.
Beautiful, but demanding.
Exactly. The magazine points out that a game with this much visual chaos desperately needed the processing power of the new Switch 2 just to run properly without crashing.
Right.
We demand these massive graphical leaps. But right next to that preview, iGaming has this massive sobering headline, PlayStation's Big Shift, Why Physical Games Are Losing the Fight.
The juxtaposition of those two stories highlights the central irony of modern gaming technology.
It really does. So I have to ask, if physical games are losing the fight, are we about to see the end of game boxes entirely? Like, are physical game discs about to become museum artifacts sitting next to VHS tapes?
This raises an important question about the hidden cost of our technological progress. On one hand, we have games like Demon Slayer pushing the absolute boundaries of what portable hardware can do.
Right.
To render those massive elemental anime attacks, the game requires incredibly advanced processors and just gigabytes upon gigabytes of data. We, as consumers, are constantly demanding bigger, faster, more beautiful digital worlds with zero load times.
We want to be able to see, like, every single reflection of light off the blade of the sword.
Precisely. But as the visual fidelity gets more advanced, the file size of the game expands astronomically. We are reaching a point where it is physically impossible, or at least highly unprofitable, for publishers to compress these massive files onto a standard plastic disc or a tiny cartridge.
That makes total sense.
So, As our hardware reaches new heights to give us what we want, our physical ownership of the media is quietly evaporating. We are trading permanence for digital convenience and high-end performance.
Meaning you don't actually own the game anymore. You just own a digital license to access the game on a corporate server.
Essentially, yes.
And theoretically, if that company goes bankrupt or just decides they don't want to pay for the server space anymore, they can flip a switch and the game you paid $70 for just ceases to exist.
That is the harsh reality of the digital shift. We are no longer buyers. We are effectively renting access to these digital playgrounds. The physical box you used to hold in your hands is being replaced by a string of code in the cloud.
So what does this all mean? If you're listening to this, maybe you haven't picked up a gaming controller in a decade. Maybe you think a Nintendo Switch is just like a colorful light fixture on your wall.
Fair enough.
But you have to understand that gaming is the prevailing cultural and financial current of 2026. It dictates the direction of global entertainment. It dictates where billions of dollars in consumer spending are flowing.
Everywhere you look.
It's even dictating the domestic rules and written contracts drawn up across kitchen tables in people's homes. It isn't just a part of the culture, it is the culture.
And if we look at where this is all heading, I want to leave you with a thought that really builds on everything we've untangled today.
Okay, let's hear it.
Earlier, we discussed a man going to federal prison for a decade over stealing $21,000 worth of physical, tangible Pokemon cards. But if physical media is truly dying and ownership is shifting entirely to servers, what happens to the next generation's equivalent of those cards?
Oh, wow. I hadn't even thought about the collectible market.
Right. If every game, every character, and every rare item becomes a digital download locked to a central corporate server that you have no legal control over, will the concept of a tangible, life-changing, rare collectible just entirely disappear into the cloud?
That's a huge question.
Or will human nature prevail? And we'll just find a new, even stranger way to hoard, value, and inevitably steal our digital treasures when there is no cardboard left to hold.
That is a terrifying and absolutely fascinating question to end on. When the screen bleeds so far into reality that the things we value most don't even exist in the physical world anymore, it really makes you wonder where the boundaries are going to end up.
If there are any left.
Exactly. Or if there will be any boundaries left at all. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the sources today. It's been an absolute trip. We'll catch you on the next one.